Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. William Lee. Dr. Lee is an international expert on health and fighting disease based on diet, lifestyle, and a new approach called angiogenesis, which means keeping the body's blood vessels in balance. As president and founder of the Angiogenesis Foundation, he's leading worldwide efforts to bring revolutionary ways to prevent and treat cancer, diabetes, blindness, heart disease, obesity, and more than 70 other conditions. Dr. Lee created the Eat to Beat Cancer program, which has spread to more than 40 countries. His wildly popular TED Talk, Can We Eat to Starve Cancer?, has been seen by more than 5 million people. So now, Will, my dad and I are so excited about your groundbreaking work, and we're so glad to have you with us. And now, for this interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Will, for being with us today.
My pleasure.
You know, when I saw your TED Talk and was so impressed by it, I was thinking about last year's annual meeting of the American Association for Cancer Research. There were 18,000 researchers and doctors and other health professionals there. There was an evening reception hosted by the MD Anderson Cancer Center, at which there was a dinner, and the guests ate there was a sumptuous buffet that included thick slabs of roast beef and a large variety of rich cheeses. There were no vegetables. And afterward came the Cancer Research Association's grand celebration with its sumptuous dessert buffet. It just boggled my mind, really, that this could happen, that these would be the foods they would serve at a time when we know obesity is causing more fatal cancers than cigarettes. So, Will, what I want to ask you is, how did you first come to seriously consider the possibility that cancer treatment and cancer prevention might be connected to food?
Well, I'm a doctor, a medical doctor, internal medicine by training, and I'm very pro-medicine. I trained at Massachusetts General Hospital, a Harvard teaching hospital at Boston, and I spent the last 30 years as a hardcore molecular and cellular scientist, and I actually helped to develop many new drugs for cancer and other diseases. But, my feeling is that the right medicine for the right person at the right time can mean the difference between life and death. But in my career, I also realized something else, and that is that the way healthcare often works is unsustainable. And when you take a look at the average cost to develop a single new medicine can exceed $1 billion a year and take more than a decade, and that new treatments for diseases like cancer, even after they're approved by the FDA, wind up being on the order of $200,000 or more a year, most of the people around the world will never get the benefit of the treatments that carry such a high cost and are really chasing the horse of the disease after it's come out of the barn. So I realize we can't rely on medicine alone to save us. So my organization at the Angiogenesis Foundation, which I helped to create in 1994, has been conducting research and analyzing scientific evidence because we came to recognize that fruits, vegetables, herbs, beverages made from teas and coffees, and even seed-generated substances like cacao contain natural substances, bioactives, that are sometimes as powerful as the drugs we develop that in terms of preventing and intercepting diseases. And we also recognize that about 80% of deaths from non-communicable diseases like cancer and heart disease and diabetes and others can be prevented by diet and lifestyle. So what I did is put my organization onto a program where we began using the tools of modern science, indeed the same tools used to develop modern biotechnology medicines, and we turned those tools to study foods instead. And the results are startling.
Can you tell us some of those startling results?
Right. So we actually began looking at foods like soy, like tea, like broccoli, and other foods, and we compared the food, whole foods that we extracted using modern laboratory methods and compared them to cancer drugs. And when we actually tested these food extracts using the same laboratory tools that are used by pharmaceutical companies to develop drugs, we were able to do head-to-head comparisons and often found the same or even higher levels of activity. We found that that wasn't enough, and we needed to be able to correlate this with public health information as well, because the proof in the pudding at the end of the day is whether or not foods would actually reduce the risk of cancer. So we have a program at the Angiogenesis Foundation that is built around both the hardcore molecular science of food. We study food just like we would study biotechnology drugs, and then we correlate those results in how they interfere with diseases like cancer with public health information to see how these foods actually perform in large real-world populations.
You talk about angiogenesis. That may be a new term for our audience, for some folks. It's the process by which our bodies grow new blood vessels, essentially. In what ways is angiogenesis involved in cancer?
Right. So angiogenesis is how our body grows blood vessels, and it's actually critical to life itself. What's interesting about angiogenesis is that it is now being recognized, blood vessels growth, as the as a new defense system in the body. In other words, if you have too few blood vessels in the body, the cells can't survive because they don't have enough oxygen or nutrients. And on the other hand, if you have too many blood vessels, those same vessels can feed diseases and increase the damage that's caused to organs by the disease. So think about angiogenesis like another defense system, like the immune system. Too much is bad. That is autoimmunity. Too little, immune deficiency is bad. You want to have just right. I often use the analogy of the fairy tale of Goldilocks. You know, not you don't want too much or too little. You want just the right amount for health. And that's really the central dogma of how angiogenesis or blood vessels help us stay healthy and how we can actually use diet to help ensure that our blood vessels are just in the right amount for balance.
I hear you saying that if we have too few blood vessels, then our cells and our organs aren't properly nourished, and they may begin to deteriorate or even die. And yet, if we have too many blood vessels, this can lead to illnesses, and I'm thinking of things like cancer and macular degeneration. So, Will, how can we know if the angiogenesis in our bodies is in balance or not, and what can we do to help improve that balance?
Yeah, great question. So here's the thing. Researchers are still working on different methods to measure angiogenesis in the body, and it's different in different organs and in different tissues at different times. So the balance occurs at the tissue organ, at tissue level, at the organ level, and how we know when angiogenesis is in balance is when we're functioning normally. How we know presently when angiogenesis is out of balance is when we associate and we see the signs of disease.
Well, here at the Food Revolution Network, one of our goals is to improve health and reduce cancer rates by promoting cancer-fighting foods. Based on the latest medical evidence, are there practical, healthy, and tasty food choices that people can make every day at every meal to incorporate cancer-fighting foods into their diets?
Absolutely, John. The scientific evidence has accumulated over the last 30 years shows that we can actually measure what foods can do in the body using rigorous research. And what we're finding is that certain foods, when consumed in the proper amount, at the right frequency, when it's sourced the right way and prepared in the right way, can dramatically impact your health, including the prevention of cancer and even improve cancer survival. And the range of foods that actually can do this are many of the ones that you would think associated with a diet that is rich in fruits and vegetables and seeds and nuts and minimal in meat. And so it falls right in line with the what we now know is the building blocks of a healthy diet, and in fact, very similar to a Mediterranean diet.
I saw a study of 29,000 women, and it showed that eating leafy green vegetables, either one cup raw or one half cup cooked per day, in this case, lowered ovarian cancer risk by a staggering amount, 66% reduction in ovarian cancer risk. Now, leafy greens, we know, are packed with an arsenal of cancer-fighting phytonutrients, including isothiocyanates. Will, how do these substances help reduce cancer risk so significantly, and can they even help fight cancer once it's established in the body?
Yeah, John, this is a great and question and one that I'm very interested in. We've been looking at green leafy vegetables and what they contain, and as you mentioned, the isothiocyanates. And you know, isothiocyanates are protective against cancers of the lung, in the GI tract, in reproductive cancers like ovarian cancer. And what's helpful to understand is how they work. First of all, let's start with where they're found. Isothiocyanates are actually breakdown products from substances, natural chemicals that are found in cruciferous vegetables, so the leafy greens. And when you eat one of those vegetables and you chew them, and so chewing becomes important, the act of chewing the vegetables, you actually crush the plant cells and you release chemicals called glucosinolates that are stored in the plant cells. And as you keep on chewing, there's another enzyme that's in that cruciferous dark green leafy vegetable called myrosinase. And the enzyme digests the glucosinate, and eureka, what you actually wind up with is the isothiocyanate. So in other words, right from the get-go, when you put a piece of broccoli in your mouth or a piece of kale and you chew it, you're starting a chemical chain reaction based on what Mother Nature's already baked into the plant to release and generate a byproduct that can actually help fight cancer. Now, researchers have looked at many different ways that isothiocyanates work to interfere with cancer. One thing that we know these isothiocyanates do is they interfere with the cell pathways that cancer cells need to grow. Isothiocyanates also are anti-inflammatory, and we know that inflammation is really important for cancer formation. And isothiocyanates actually also reduce the formation of carcinogens. So there's a really interesting study in smokers that found that, you know, if you took people who are actively smoking and you fed them only 6 ounces a day of watercress, a dark leafy green that contains isothiocyanates, when you chew them, that eating that watercress will reduce the activation of the carcinogens found in tobacco. It's really quite amazing. The other thing about isothiocyanates, it's right at my wheelhouse, is that they actually inhibit angiogenesis. So when you chew these dark leafy greens, release these byproducts that you then swallow, and they get into your bloodstream, they will actually cut off the blood supply feeding cancer cells. So if you actually have cancer, just eating these foods will actually help boost your body's protective effect to prevent cancers from getting their own nutrients. Secondly, if you're at risk for cancer, which everybody is, eating foods containing isothiocyanates can help to create an environment in your body that's suppressive for angiogenesis to feed cancers. In other words, anti-angiogenic, cancer-starving, preventing cancers from hijacking the blood supply to feed themselves is cancer preventative.
You're talking about dark green leafy veggies like watercress and the cruciferous veggies, of which watercress is one. Kale, collards, mustard greens, and broccoli are also. I'm also thinking about the lighter colored vegetables in that same family, cauliflower and cabbage. And I'm thinking in particular of a study of 350,000 people that found that those who ate even a quarter cup a day of cabbage, which is really not a great deal, it's a quarter cup a day, nearly halved their chances of getting cancers of the upper gut. To me, these are staggering statistics that give us evidence that we really could prevent a significant number of the cancers that are taking place. Well, if we were truly to get serious about our diets and our lifestyles, and if we were to eat an optimally cancer-fighting diet, what percentage of cancer cases might we actually prevent?
Yeah, so cancer is one of the leading causes of death in the world, and the National Cancer Institute reported that in 2016. So last year, there were 1.7 million new cases of cancer and about 600,000 cancer-related deaths. That's a lot of disease burden for society, and you got to realize that we're seeing cancers take out people who are young in their prime of their life and active contributors to society. So there's an economic or an indirect cost as well. But many cases of cancers are preventable, as you know, from smoking cessation, lifestyle factors, you know, not being a couch potato, not drinking too much and wearing sunscreen. But what's interesting is the contribution of diet. So all other things being equal, the American Institute of Cancer Research estimates that about a third of cancers are preventable by diet alone, a third. So what that means is that we hold our own destiny three times a day in the choices that we're making when we're setting out to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And that's why I think to get serious about diet and health and cancer reduction also means that we have to get serious about the science, understand why this happens, and develop the evidence that can actually make this more an everyday practicable habit in society.
We're often advised to eat bright colors, berries, and we're directed to think about the pigments in foods like purple potatoes and blueberries and dark orange carrots and squash and the yellow in avocados as clues. Are these foods particularly helpful in fighting cancer?
Yes, John, you're actually right about that. The pigments that we find in foods that make them so colorful when you walk into the grocery store or, you know, if you're traveling into a farmer's market, our eyes are instantly drawn towards colorful foods. Well, those pigments that make foods colorful are actually the bioactives, and they had a reason to develop over evolution. And if you think about bioactives in plants that created food, so plant-based foods. And you go all the way back to, you know, early days where these plants were starting to form, you know, in prehistory. You got to realize these bioactives were created for the plant, not for people. In a plant, they tended to do two things. One is these bioactives were natural insecticides, so they prevented bugs from eating them. So many types of protective factors, in fact, insects don't like. But the other things is that the pigments that make plants really colorful tended to attract bees that would then pollinate the plant, ensuring its survival. And so colorful pigments that are bioactives originally had the function of helping the plant survive and reproduce over time. Now, when man, you know, when humans started to eat plant-based foods that contain these pigments, so think of your bright-colored carrots or your purple potato, and we put these foods in our mouth and we ate them, suddenly those same chemicals that served the plant had another job description when they got into the human. They started to interact with our cells. And what's interesting is that the darker, the more pigmented colored bioactives really have profound effects. So, for example, and we know what these are, by the way. So, for example, the purple in a Peruvian purple potato is made from anthocyanin. So we know the molecule. In beets, bright red beets or dark red beets, it's called beta-cyanin. And in avocados, you know, there's lutein. And each of these dyes actually, when we swallow them, actually interact with our cells. Some interesting clinical correlations. Papayas, right? We see them when we're traveling to a beachfront tropical place, or sometimes on a salad bar. One of the most interesting brightly colored foods, the bright orange, comes from a natural chemical called beta-cryptoxanthin. And this pigment, beta-cryptoxanthin, has been shown to prevent even the earliest forms of cancer. So, for example, in women who are infected by the human papillomavirus, HPV, that causes abnormal pap smears and can be a precursor to cervical cancer, a study of Pius found that women who had been infected by HPV, who ate half a cup of fresh papayas a week, had an 80% reduced risk of developing the earliest stages of cervical cancer. So think of color as a sign of health, right? I mean, when we see something really pale, we think of it as not as healthy. When we think of something colorful, we think of health. And I think that eating colorful fruits and vegetables is something that we're naturally drawn to do. And now there's some science to back it up.
When you're talking about the bioactives and the colors, I was thinking about tomatoes and lycopene.
Yeah.
They are great sources of lycopene. And I saw one study where women who ate the equivalent of a single small tomato every day had a 40% lower breast cancer risk. From the point of view of cancer prevention, does it matter whether the tomatoes are raw or cooked?
Yeah, well, first of all, tomatoes are not just good for women, they're also good for men. There's another big study, around 70,000 men, the Harvard Health Professional studies that showed that men who had about a half cup of tomatoes, cooked tomatoes, that tomato sauce, 2 to 3 times a week, had about a 40% risk of prostate cancer. So if you think about breast cancer and prostate cancer covering the moms and dads and the grandmas and grandpas of the world, and you realize that eating tomatoes can make a difference, well, that's a really worthy thing of putting into the diet. So you asked about cooking versus raw. Here's an interesting fact when you think about why it is that tomatoes are good for you. Now, we know that tomatoes have lycopene, and lycopene is the bioactive that can help interfere with cancer development. And it turns out that the lycopene in a raw tomato that you pick off a vine in the garden is in a chemical structure that your body has a hard time absorbing. In fact, most of it, about 80% of it, passes through your body out into the toilet. Eating tomato in a salad might be really tasty and might give you some vitamins, but you're not getting those cancer fighters at concentrations that you would want to have. On the other hand, tomatoes are much better for you when you cook them. When you cook tomatoes, their lycopene levels increase. In fact, sauteing a tomato for 15 minutes or more will make the amount of lycopene rise by 50% or more. So how you cook food can make a big difference. Here's another thing about cooking tomatoes. If you cook tomatoes, a really great way to heat tomatoes is using extra virgin olive oil, another healthy oil that comes from Mediterranean product, the olive. And it turns out that you can easily heat a tomato in olive oil, convert all those hard-to-absorb lycopene molecules into easy-to-absorb molecules. So I didn't mention that when you cook them, you actually flip the switch so that about 80% of the lycopene is absorbed by the body into the bloodstream. So cooking tomatoes actually can increase the amount of lycopene, the right kind of lycopene your body can absorb. And if you do it with olive oil, you'll actually help to get that up to temperature in the right way. And if you think about it, then you've got really tomato sauce, and we go right back to the Mediterranean diet.
So I'm hearing that cooked tomatoes are, we can absorb the lycopene much better.
Yeah.
And am I hearing also that if we combine cooked tomatoes with olive oil, then the absorption of lycopene increases yet again?
Yeah, that's right, because lycopene is naturally a fat-soluble molecule, meaning that when you just drink it with water, for example, it doesn't mix very well. And since our blood is mostly water, when you actually have lycopene with oil and the oil helps to absorb it into the bloodstream, it kind of carries it right into your stomach and gets in your bloodstream easier. So you take the cooked lycopene that your body can absorb, you combine it with the olive oil, which helps to dissolve it and make it easier for your body to absorb. Now you've really kind of greased the skids for getting this lycopene into your body. Those Mediterraneans really knew what they were doing when they had slow simmer tomato sauce.
And the Mediterranean diet has shown so many beneficial effects.
Right.
I want to ask you about a couple of other foods.
Sure.
What is the impact of green tea on cancer?
Well, green tea has really become almost universally known as a healthy beverage. And, you know, if you go back to Asia, ancient Asia, it's actually one of the most popular beverages in the world. I think tea is, in fact, the second most popular beverage in the world, second to water. And the science and public health studies on green tea are now really starting to stack up. There's a study called the Shanghai Women's Health Study that looked at 69,000 women and found that those who drank green tea at least three times a week had about a 37% reduction in the risk of developing colon cancer compared to women who didn't drink green tea. So think about that. Drinking a beverage three times a week lowers your risk by a third for colon cancer. And similar findings exist for stomach cancer and even ovarian cancer. Cancers, you know, the T's in the gut. So you might expect some benefits in the gut. But it also has catechins. These are natural molecules. They're the heavyweights in green tea that gets absorbed into your bloodstream. And you can also prevent ovarian cancer and other types of cancers as well, including skin cancers. What's interesting is that catechins, the bioactives from tea, although they can impact on cancer cells directly, it seems like they're much more powerful in cutting off the blood supply, feeding small cancers. In other words, green tea is an excellent anti-angiogenic beverage to prevent cancers from growing.
What about cinnamon? Does it also have anti-cancer effects?
Yeah, cinnamon is a really interesting spice. You know, as we're talking, it's almost like we're walking through a pantry in the kitchen and picking out interesting items and, you know, trying to learn more about them and, you know, share them with folks who similarly go into their kitchens and are wondering what should I put in my food or what should I cook with. So let's talk about cinnamon. Cinnamon actually comes from the tree bark, and it's about 4,000 years old. So it is a really, really ancient product. It was used, in fact, in the old spice trades. And there's been a number of studies looking at cinnamon because it's been known to have medicinal value going all the way back to the ancient days. What I can tell you now is that we've identified bioactives like cinnamic acid that can interfere with cancer growth. Cinnamic acid in cinnamon is anti-angiogenic, meaning it cuts off the blood supply, killing cancer cells. And it can also be anti-inflammatory. There's antimicrobial, it's anti-diabetic properties as well. And so here's, again, an ancient spice used over the centuries that has been well known to have healthful properties. And now we're just beginning to use real science to tease apart what's going on and what they do. Now, there's been a recent study by the U.S. Department of Agriculture that looked at cinnamon, and they looked at extracts from cinnamon, and they found that, in fact, cinnamon extracts can prevent a molecule that biotech companies develop drugs to go after called vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF. This is the growth factor that cancer cells release in order to grow a blood supply. So this study showed that an extract from cinnamon can knock out that bad guy that cancer cells create, that growth factor, again, supporting the fact that cinnamon might really be a reservoir for some useful molecules that we can not only enjoy great taste and have great flavor, but also can be helpful for our health. Now, I want to give you a caveat to that, John, and that's, you know, for every benefit, you know, there's so the, you know, the Paracelsus once said, the difference between the cure and the poison is the dose. And for cinnamon, the caution is that cinnamon also contains other bioactives like coumarin. And coumarin sounds a lot like the drug Coumadin, which thins the blood. In fact, that's, you know, where they got the concept of Coumadin. And Coumadin, which thins the blood, can also cause kidney damage when you give it in high doses. So that's why, you know, I don't recommend people use cinnamon as a drug and to really, you know, eat huge quantities of cinnamon. But what I would say is that there are so many dishes where you can actually use healthful spices as a way of lighting up your taste buds, really making a meal enjoyable. And now you know that you can also get some healthy molecules just by flavoring your food as well.
Well, do we know what the limit might be on how much cinnamon we should be eating? I mean, I'm hearing that it's good in a certain dosage, but too much would have adverse effects. So how will people know what the right amount to eat might be?
Yeah, so here's my rule of thumb when it comes to spices, because we're just really, researchers are still really just beginning to tease apart this whole dose effect in the concept, in the realm of spices. I would say don't use spice as a drug. Use it as a flavor-enhancing, health-enhancing additive. So if you're actually flavoring a food, you know, your hot apple cider or putting onto an apple pie, or whether you're flavoring a cake, that's fantastic. Just know that what you're making the food taste good with is also good for you. So I think, you know, just to recap, spices should be used for how they help make our foods flavorful. Choose them for that reason. Don't use more spice than it would take. In other words, don't use so much spice that it wouldn't taste good. And I think our bodies will titrate how much you would accept. And that's another thing, is that somehow over the, you know, course of evolution, we kind of know how much we should be taking in. And you know how animals will eat certain foods and not eat certain foods. I would say follow our own instincts, our own primal instincts about how much we should be eating, rather than, you know, following some kind of dictum that somebody says you got to eat X amount of spice, just because we don't know everything about it and it could be dangerous.
I'm hearing you actually talk about the wisdom of the body, the natural intelligence of the body, and that if we, in this case with cinnamon, eat the amount that tastes good to us,
right,
we're probably getting the right amount for its anti-cancer effects. And that if we put it in a capsule and swallowed it, we would bypass our taste buds. We wouldn't have any idea really how much we were taking or what it was doing to us.
Yeah, I always recommend using the whole food in its freshest natural form compared to a capsule of any sort. And by the way, oftentimes when we combine things like cinnamon, which has cancer-fighting activity, with, let's say you put it in hot apple cider, you wanted to choose a cider that's made with cloudy, you know, the cloudy type of, not clear apple juice because that's filtered, but the cloudy apple cider contains all those proanthocyanins that are found in apples. Those are cancer fighters too. So it's not that we're looking at, you know, cinnamon as the treatment. We're looking at the combination, let's say a beverage that's not only tasty and warming and comfort generating, but also something that's also good for our bodies. So follow the body, the wisdom of the body.
When you talked about foods, whole foods, rather than supplements made from isolated substances within them, I was thinking about red wine. We hear a lot about red wine reducing cancer risk. We hear a lot about it containing resveratrol as kind of the magic substance there. Some people, including many of them in 12-step programs like AA, really shouldn't drink any alcohol at all. What about taking resveratrol supplements? Is that a valuable thing to do?
Yeah, so the first thing about, you know, our research coming at red wine is that resveratrol is probably important, but it's clearly not the only thing. There are thousands of natural bioactives that occur in wine. Think about it. You take red grapes, you put them into a fermentation vat to make wine, and it takes years. And it's true, alcohol develops, and you get, you know, wine solids that develop, and you get must that develops, and the alcohol then further extracts natural bioactives into the red wine. We know resveratrol is good. It actually is anti-angiogenic, and it's cancer. It kills cancer cells as well. It's a polyphenol. However, what we don't know is how much resveratrol you really need. And so when you sort of isolate the resveratrol, put it in a capsule, and start swallowing it, you know, you're probably not hurting yourself by having these supplements to, you know, up to a certain point, but you're probably not really getting the full benefit of the natural substance. And so what I would say is concentrate less on the individual bioactive. You should know that they exist, but concentrate on the whole food. So for example, someone who can't really eat wine, I would recommend eating red grapes. Now you're actually getting the vitamins, you're getting the minerals, you're getting the fiber from a grape, and you're probably getting also many of the natural chemicals that are also present in red wine. And I can name some of them, like quercetin, maraschitin, anthocyanin, the list goes on and on. So I would say, people who have to be careful about alcohol can easily find alternatives to alcohol itself in order to find these cancer-fighting bioactives.
Well, for those of us who can drink alcohol, of course, we don't want to do it excessively. The evidence for that is just absolutely overwhelming. But we might want to get the biggest bang for our buck.
Sure.
We will, the highest anti-cancer potency in our red wines from red grapes. Is it true that Cabernet Sauvignons are higher in anti-cancer potency than other varieties, and particularly than Petite Syrahs?
Yeah, so you're asking sort of the Robert Parker of science question, right? You're saying you go into a wine store and you're looking at all these, hundreds of wines that you could actually buy, and there's a rating next to each wine, and the rating, sometimes a higher rating means a higher cost per bottle, but somebody's actually judged something about the quality of the wine. Well, I'll tell you what we're doing at the Angiogenesis Foundation. We've dove in and created some partnerships with some wineries. Same soil, same terroir. The only difference are the different varietals of grapes, and they're making the wine. And we're actually studying what makes the difference between one wine versus another after it's in the bottle and after it's ready to be served. So what we're finding is really interesting. We are finding that, in fact, absolutely correct, that Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc wines, grape varietals, actually have a huge amount of anti-angiogenic activity. But not the only ones. In fact, if you take a look at the body of research that's out there, not only do Cabernet grapes have resveratrol and other bioactives, another type of grape that's actually quite good, and I have to remark, quite tasty as wine, is Pinot Noir. Now, Pinot Noir actually has some of the highest levels of resveratrol for any grape. And so the question is, why? Why Pinot Noir? So it turns out that Pinot Noir grapes tend to grow in slightly humid areas. And remember, I was remarking on the fact that Mother Nature or evolution, during evolution, some of these bioactives, like resveratrol, evolved to really defend the plant. Well, it turns out resveratrol is a natural fungicide that prevents Pinot Noir grapes from developing a grape disease called noble rot. This was actually a big problem for winemakers when they were growing fields of grapes, and they would actually get this fungus on them and ruin them. It turns out the Pinot Noir grapes have a lot of resveratrol that resists that fungus. So again, this is not just about, health food stores and people trying to write cookbooks and, give health advice. I think that if you go back to science, if you go back to nature and really ask the question, why is it that these molecules exist, it gives us better clues and gives us a better appreciation of why eating fresh whole foods is good for you.
As I listen to you, I get the feeling that foods could help us start a new war against cancer.
Right. Well, listen, I think that the traditional war against cancer was ignited in the early 1970s by Richard Nixon signing a presidential decree. The National Cancer Act was the official war against cancer. And what came out of that? Chemotherapy. Now, chemotherapy is actually very important as one of the tools that oncologists use, doctors use in order to be able to beat cancer. And, there are cancers that can be cured with chemotherapy, so we cannot take that fact lightly. And as an aside, what's really interesting, John, is the history of chemotherapy. There was, the first chemotherapies were mustard gases that were being hidden in a warship that was illegally parked in Italy during World War II. And when the Germans bombed the Italian town of Bari and accidentally hit this warship, it released the toxins out, killed tons of soldiers and sailors, and also killed lots of people in the town. But a few cancer patients survived. And they were asking, how is it that this poison, which was later called chemotherapy, could have actually not killed the cancer patients? And it turned out that it killed their cancer. So the war against cancer literally had its roots from a treatment perspective in real wars with real weapons. What we're talking about now with food is a completely different type of approach. I wouldn't even call it a war. I would say that it's really a winning approach to keeping us healthy by not having to go to war. It's a peace approach. It's a diplomat's approach. We can neutralize the enemy without ever having to pull out a nasty weapon. And that's really because, you know, we have to eat food three times a day. That's over 1,000 choices of meals that we make a year. And if we have that knowledge about which foods contain bioactives and what types of cancers that they can actually reduce. And that's one of the whole points of this Eat to Beat program that we developed, to connect people with simple tips and the information that they can help to choose from. It's a free sign up, eattobeat.org, through my nonprofit organization. It's a community of people over 40 countries. There's more than 50,000 people that are all passionate about food and interested in making choices, lifestyle choices, to help defeat cancer. This is really, I think, the approach. So let's not think about it as a war against cancer. Let's call it really a way, sort of a peacetime approach to maintaining health. And so one of the things that we are really committed to doing is offering people who join Eat to Beat, an e-cookbook, a digital cookbook with cancer-fighting recipes, easy, simple, convenient, that really also take the best of science and put them in the hands of people that can take it out to their shopping, their grocery store, or just put it on their counter and make cooking decisions with it, breakfast, lunch, or dinner.
Well, listening to you talk is such a pleasure. Eat to beat, indeed. And you give new meaning to the old saying that food is a medicine we take three times a day. And you help us to understand what we can do, the lifestyle choices we can make, the food choices we can make to reduce our risk for cancer and other diseases, to live healthy lives filled with vitality and vibrancy and the capacity to really to fulfill the purposes for which we're here on this earth. It's really a joy to bring your message, your voice to our audience. And I, on behalf of Ocean and on myself and really everyone involved in the Food Revolution Network, I want to thank you, Will, for your work and for being with us today.
Well, it's really my pleasure. It is a terrific honor to be speaking with you and to be able to communicate my, the research that we've been doing and what my nonprofit organization is leading the charge. I think that it is truly a food revolution, and it's time for us to take back our health and make it possible from childhood to healthy aging, something that everybody can look forward to as opposed to run from. Food should be something that we enjoy in order to be healthy rather than something that we avoid from a disease perspective. So I have my kind of closing is, enjoy your life, enjoy your food, know what you're putting in your body, and protect your health.
Absolutely beautiful. We've been talking with Dr. William Lee, founding president of the Angiogenesis Foundation and creator of the Eat to Defeat Cancer program. Will, your research and understanding the role of anti-angiogenesis in cancer protection is exhilarating. Your leadership in helping us to all understand and implement your findings could save millions of lives. We're so grateful for your research, for your wisdom, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you, John and Ocean.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's That's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.